worldly joy, which, as I mentioned, is not a pejorative term. But then the Buddha, of course, goes into more refinement, which he refers to as non-worldly joy. And here he's speaking really about the joy that is generated inwardly, that really has nothing to do with the sense doors, that has little to do with the world of conditions. It has to do with the climate and the understanding, actually, of our own hearts and minds. The first domain of this is the Buddha describes the outcome of a life rooted in integrity and ethics as a life filled with the joy of blamelessness, where we do go to bed at night without regret about what we have done or not done, said or not said, where there's a certain kind of completeness found within our thoughts and words and actions that leave no residue behind. In fact, in several discourses, the Buddha describes nibbana as the freedom from residues. The freedom from residues, those lingering thoughts of regret, shame, blame, guilt, judgment. And he says, you know, that this is a life that is born of this embodied integrity, this embodied ethics in our thoughts, words, and acts. And you can see a little bit of a continuum here, because with metta, we're really learning to uproot the tendency of aversion and ill will, which, of course, is so much of the source of residues, isn't it? You don't really feel many residues of metta. You know, I really wish I hadn't been so kind. Wish I hadn't been so caring. You know, it doesn't leave those kind of residues behind. So aversion is very much the root of those residues and the source of unethical acts and words and thoughts that actually take us to places far from where we want to be and have much to do with actually the uncomfortable sense of dissonance that we can live with, where we feel that our life is really not aligned with what we most deeply value. So ethics, as I mentioned yesterday in the discussion of metta, is actually the expression of metta that forms relationships of respect, fearlessness, and the necessary foundation of mudita, or empathic joy. Joy is also spoken of as piti. Some of you might be familiar with this word, piti, piti, P-I-T-I. It really is often referred to much more as rapture or the blissfully joyful states associated with deep concentration absorptions. Now, the Buddha, any of you who are familiar with, at all with the texts cannot overlook the degree to which the Buddha stresses the development of a deeply concentrated mind, developing that capacity for very deep, deep collectedness. And, you know, you see the word jhanas, or referring to these absorption states, of course, repeated over and over again in the text. Far more, actually, than insight. And, you know, we kind of wonder, well, why that is so? Because, you know, Buddha grew up in a time where the whole spiritual ethos was concentration as an end in itself. It was the primary practice in the time that the Buddha lived, and he engaged in that practice actually for a number of years and then turned away from it, so really saying that it really didn't deliver the lasting freedom that he was speaking or seeking for. So he actually turned away from those pathways and developed the pathways of panya or insight and understanding and mindfulness rooted in the classroom of our lives rather than in a transcendent state. And yet it is clear from reading the Buddha's teaching that the enormous value that the Buddha gives to this capacity of the mind for deep collectedness and deep absorption. Now, what the caveat that the Buddha puts in is he cautions against pursuing these states as ends in themselves, because they can be a little bit addictive. You know, who doesn't want a little rapture in their life, you know? And if you have the chance for a lot more, you know, it can feel very compelling and, you know, almost addictive. But the fact that the Buddha cautioned against these does obviously not make them unworthy, because I think what is probably the most worthy part of developing deep concentration states is the glimpse that they give of really an unarguable, inwardly generated joy. It's unarguable. Now, there is a certain, there is a certain insight also associated with that, because if one really glimpses that powerful, profound, inwardly generated joy, it rather changes our relationship to the world of experience. And it rather changes the whole tendency towards craving, which is outwardly focused and looking and positing happiness, pleasure in objects and experiences and events as something to get. So it really kind of tones down the whole craving impulse, because it doesn't make sense anymore. Simply because it doesn't make sense anymore. You know, in terms of the joy that is generated through deep concentration states compared to a momentary sense of satisfaction derived from getting something, you know, it's kind of like turning up at the dining table and being offered a 5-course meal or a bucket of nails to eat. You know, which one are you going to go for? You know, and the inwardly generated joy is the 5-course meal. So I think the encounter, I think, with this level, this vast potential of our hearts to know this inwardly generated joy has a very wholesome effect on how we relate to the world around us. Muting, toning down, and making more transparent the whole impulse of craving, which is about getting something we feel we don't have within ourselves. But it is also, of course, it is what makes the mind a true friend. You know, this sense of inner collectedness, of gatheredness, of ease, of spaciousness, it is really what makes the mind a true friend, a mind of inner sufficiency. This is one of the dimensions of kind of non-worldly joy. It also, one of course, is when the concentration states are spoken of, they say they blind Mara. They blind the hindrance factors. They render the hindrance factors inoperative. So craving, aversion, dullness, restlessness and worry, doubt, all of these are rendered inoperative. And, of course, this looks pretty good, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But, of course, there's also that caveat that, you know, when the Buddha talks about concentration states in the text, he always talks about turning that collected, gathered mind towards the development of insight. Because this is where the mind has access, actually, underneath the narrative. And if you want to give an example, you know, one line from the text where the Buddha speaks about the mind that is really a friend, that is really abiding in this deeply collected place, free from fragmentation. The Buddha describes it as a mind that is a master of the courses of thought. And he says what that means is that you think the thoughts you want to think when you want to think them. And you don't think the thoughts that you don't want to think. That mind. That mind as a potential for all of us. Okay? So this is a kind of non-worldly joy. And there's a dimension of joy highly spoken of in the suttas, which is born of a heartfelt appreciation of ourselves, of others, the joy of gratitude. And, you know, in monastic settings, of course, a time is dedicated each day to remembering our blessings, remembering what is good, fostering that sense of gratitude. And Martin Luther King Jr., he once says, whether we realize it or not, each of us lives eternally in the red. We are everlasting debtors to known and unknown women and men. When we arise in the morning, we go to the bathroom and reach for a sponge provided for us by a Pacific Islander. We reach for soap created for us by a European. Then at the table, we drink coffee provided for us by a South American, or tea by a Chinese, or cocoa by a West African. Before we leave the house, we are already beholden to more than half of the world. And one has a sense with joy, as with all of the Brahmaviharas, it is both widening our circle of concern, widening our circle of appreciation, and our circle of care. It takes some pausing to remembering that quality of gratitude. But again, we come to know that our life is the gift of many. And joy is not a denial or the pain of feeling, you know, that we don't have enough, or we've never had enough love or acceptance or support in our life. And yet it is really rooting us in sati, a present moment recollection, not focused upon the past with all of its afflictions and all of its adversity, but rooting us in a present moment recollection of here we are in the only life we can live, and choosing moment to moment where we make our home. Whether we make our home in regret and a feeling of lack, or whether we make our home in resentment or blame, or in our capacity for generosity and for appreciation. But appreciation, this quality of gratitude and appreciation, is not something only externally directed. It is also internally offered. There is a lot of other things we could be doing today, yet here we are planting these seeds, appreciating our efforts, appreciating the sincerity we bring to our life. I think at the end of every sitting, you know, you should pat yourself on the back and say, well done. And it doesn't matter how it was. It doesn't matter how it was. And yet we see how sometimes miserly we can be in offering that appreciation inwardly, how withholding we can be. We're probably maybe afraid that we don't quite deserve us, or it's going to lead to conceit. But, you know, these are many of our sort of conditioned reactions to the possibility of joy, you know, that we don't quite merit it, you know, and we don't quite deserve appreciation. The other aspect of joy that comes really with the whole teaching of contentment for monastics, the fourth teaching in contentment, is actually celebrating the falling away of the unskillful. This is a good thing to do, you know. This is a good thing to do. I mean, we do actually make progress in practice. We do actually make progress. You know, it's not always, you know, stunning experiences. It's not always transcendent states. But you might notice you're a bit more patient in your life, or a little less judgmental, or a little less anxious, a little bit more forgiving, a little bit more generous. We do actually make progress in this path. Things fall away. And the fourth dimension of contentment is actually the celebration of seeing the falling away of what is unhelpful or unskillful. Again, it's a well done, and it's good to mark that. You know, I know many Westerners have an allergy to the word progress, but it does happen. You know, it does happen. So as an insight practice, you know, what is the insight practice? As an insight practice, this broader spectrum of joy is an antidote to craving. But craving has a family of origin. And the family of origin of craving is the ideology of insufficiency, the idea, the culture of lack, of not enough. And joy is primarily concerned with uprooting this sense of lack and insufficiency. I think that this whole ideology is so prevalent, particularly in Western culture, the ideology of not being good enough, not having enough, it's like inhabiting this kind of barren inner desert that does catapult us into being into the world of the hungry ghost. You know, it's just not enough here, so it must be elsewhere. More sensual craving, more craving to become, more craving to have, more craving to get, this sort of merciless pursuit which is never satisfied. And the Buddha speaks about continuums here, by the way. You know, he says craving is a condition for clinging. Clinging is a condition for self-making. Okay, so this is a continuum. These are not separate phenomena in the mind. They are magnifications and intensifications of one thread. So craving, think about craving, oh, I want something. No, I need something. No, I have to have something. No, then I'm this kind of person who, you know, requires this, must have this, is a failure without it. So there is this continuum between craving, aversion, clinging, and selfing. It's one thread, okay? So joy is actually starting to look and start to untangle that thread right at its beginning. It's starting to look at this whole impulse, the compulsion to get. And actually when the Buddha speaks about Nibbana, he speaks about it free from the compulsions of craving. Free from the compulsions of craving. And that clinging and grasping, of course, it triggers all the psychological and emotional events that contract the heart and close the door to joy. There is very little gladness in craving. It feels it is a hunger. It is a statement of discontent. So I think with both sati, with mindfulness, and with the cultivation of joy as one of the Brahma Viharas, we're actually learning to stop amidst the surges and the compulsions of craving. We're learning to foster and to cultivate this kind of pregnant pause in those moments when we begin to reach out or begin to push away. Being aware, when we speak about craving, it's this twofold, two-faced, isn't it? The craving and the aversion, the approach and the avoidance mechanisms. You know, and the Buddha speaks about, you know, the three dimensions of craving, the sensual pleasure, the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving to become, the craving to become the kind of person who has a certain kind of experience. I want to be the person who has fantastic meditations, happy children, wonderful vacations, health, immortality, only nice people around me, only nice things. I want to be the person who has this kind of experience. You know, I have friends who send me letters sometimes at Christmas time, the generalized letters. And sometimes my jaw drops and I think, who are these people where nothing goes wrong in their life? You know, and you can sort of say, I want to be that kind of person. You know, I never get a letter at Christmas time that says, you know, my vacation sucked, my kids are failing, I hate my body. You know, my relationship is miserable. You know, I never get that craving. We don't want, that is another aspect of craving. We don't want to be the kind of person who has that kind of experience. And of course, the extreme of that is suicidal ideation. We want to go away. You know, we want it to all end. So the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving to become, and the craving for non-becoming. This is what consumes a great deal, by the way, I might mention, of our mental energy. And our life energy. So joy is learning, the cultivation of joy is learning to pause amidst those compulsions. This is very energetic, isn't it? If you're a little bit sensitized inwardly, don't you just feel that? That kind of energetic surge of craving or pushing away? And we ask ourselves, what in this moment is truly lacking? Is there enough in this moment for sensitivity? Is there enough in this moment for compassion? Is there enough in this moment for kindness? Is there enough in this moment for spaciousness and for investigation? And then we start to see how closely the cultivation of joy, because it is a cultivation of the mind that inclines towards joy, how closely that is interwoven with sati, with mindfulness, and with metta. Learning to turn towards craving, to befriend it. Learning to turn towards the compulsions of aversion. Learning to stand near to them with an affectionate curiosity, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, with an affectionate curiosity. Ah, here you are. Here you are. This is what's going on. Let me stand near to this. Let me look at this. Let me look at how this is registering somatically. Let me see what this is doing to the mind in terms of contractedness. So we're learning to befriend those compulsions. And we see that craving really only has one taste, and it is a taste of imprisonment. Now, the curious thing is, of course, delusion factors in here, because delusion tells us that craving is a way to solve suffering. I feel discontented in the moment. I'll make the moment better. You know, I'll get this, or I'll become that, or I'll make this go away. So delusion tells us that craving is the solution to dukkha. From the perspective of the Dharma, craving is the cause of dukkha. This is quite a reversal in our thinking, you might say, and actually has the possibility of quite radically changing our lives. If we cease to believe that craving is the solution to dukkha. Now I want to go into empathic joy or altruistic joy, quite specifically within the Brahma Viharas. But does anybody have any questions? Yes, please. No. Unless you're doing it to please somebody and get affirmation and approval and applause, you know, but if you enjoy serving and making something lovely for someone, of course there is no problem. I mean, I know we hear, sorry?
How do you tell, I guess, what preference
is? It's a compulsive element. It's a compulsive element. You know, where it becomes disconnected from any kind of contentment, or, you know, it's a compulsive element. I need to do this. There's not that freedom. Oh, I don't have to do it. So it's really talking about the state of mind that's behind it and the belief systems that are behind it. Preferences, we would prefer to be warm rather than cold. We would prefer to be fed rather than starving. You know, we would prefer to be well rather than ill. You know, and I know, you know, you read that, you know, the Tao Te Ching, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Well, I don't actually think that is the aspiration in the path, to have no preferences. I mean, you know, many of them are really about just living in this world as well as we can, but it is the clinging to the preferences where the issue comes in, because that's what turns it into a compulsion. And possibly being in the service of some other need, okay? So it's, I think it's a little gentler around the preference part. But looking where it's, they're sticky. You know, if the monk goes out in the morning for the alms round, I'm sure they'd prefer there is food in the bowl rather than not. But if they're returned to the monastery with an empty bowl, that is how it is, you know, and can there be contentment with that rather than, you know, maybe I've got a secret stash here, you know, or I'm going to the next village, you know, they're more generous there. It's that quality of relinquishing the clinging to the preferences. Please. Okay, so the relation of contentment to an activity and effort and initiative and all those things, please be aware we're not talking about a bovine contentment here. You know, just chomping our way from one blade of grass to the other, you know, and this is how it is. Contentment is not a relinquishment of aspiration. It's not a relinquishment of creativity. It is a relinquishment of fixation. Being very much aware of how much of our doing can be truly an expression, an embodiment of, you know, very wholesome aspirations and creativity, and how much of our busyness and doing can be the camouflage that we lay over an underlying discontent of there not being enough. And that, of course, that's an investigation for all of us, but we're not speaking about bovine contentment. Okay, so let's go into empathic joy or altruistic joy, appreciative joy, our capacity to celebrate the happiness and the well-being of another. It's a quality of joy, I think, that arises when envy and covetousness and resentment are really falling away, but as a cultivation, it's what helps envy and covetousness and comparing to fall away. Our friend's child does better than our own. We celebrate. Someone gets a job we wanted. We're happy for them. That's a big ask, isn't it? Our neighbor goes on a wonderful vacation and we stay home. Well done. Enjoy. You know, these are very trivial examples. Very trivial examples. But I remember a couple of years ago, one of my students had severe kidney failure on a retreat, and you know, clearly it was a very life-changing event. And then I met him in the gym a year later, and he was working out, and he looked really happy. And I said, you know, what's going on? And he says, my brother is donating one of his kidneys to me. And I just, you know, it was for that real taste of just appreciative joy of the generosity of another and his happiness. I want to read you something from a Sri Lankan text. It's not a very well-known text, which uses the phrases that are actually can be part of mudita. So I want you to listen to this and see how they sink or sit with you. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue. Now I want you to turn this around and offer that to yourself. How wonderful I am in my being. I delight that I'm here. I take joy in my good fortune. May my happiness continue. I must say, when I first came across these phrases, I have to confess that my first response was to have a cringe moment. I thought, ugh, it's very sentimental, you know, and again, something I might feel or sense in the face of a cute puppy or when you fall in love. But actually, these phrases are not about sentimentality. There's a very clear quality of selflessness within them, you know, a very simple generosity. Now, I'm sure, and I touched upon this briefly yesterday, I'm sure you have all noticed that when we are most established in skillful, wholesome qualities of metta, calm, generosity, compassion, that the voice of selfing becomes so quiet. There's not a big I am present. It is almost as if the cultivation of the wholesome and the skillful unseats the centralization of selfing. We don't have a big narrative about why am I so generous, you know, I shouldn't be so generous, you know, why am I so friendly, I shouldn't be, or tender. The voice of selfing becomes quiet, and then you also notice simultaneously in that the gap and the division between self and other softens. And this is very much part of the cultivation of appreciative joy. We see ourselves in the eyes of another, just as we do with compassion. Rejoicing in their happiness, compassionate in their sadness. And then we notice that when more unskillful states are present, agitation, anxiety, aversion, how big the voice of selfing gets, how much it relies upon telling the narrative and retelling the narrative and justifying the unskillful through telling and retelling and reifying and solidifying the idea of me at the center of the universe and the distance from others that also gets reified. You are the cause of my unhappiness. You are the cause of my anxiety. It is not to say that there are not objective situations in this life that trigger anxiety and sadness. How we care for those relies a lot upon inner development. We also notice in the presence of the unwholesome how prone we are to seize upon the particulars of a person and mistake them to be the whole. And we do this inwardly also. We have an aversion attack. I'm an aversive person. We seize upon the particulars and mistake them to be a whole. Someone offends us, we see them 10 years later. There's that person who offended me. They're really an offensive person. We seize upon the particulars and mistake it to be the whole. We see their flaws, their faults, their imperfections. This dynamic happens outwardly and this dynamic happens inwardly. Some aspect of our body, we find it difficult to be with. Our emotions, we dislike, the events we judge. And we see ourselves falling into that familiar domain of selfing through seizing upon the particulars. So appreciative joy, you know, much of this path, but appreciative joy is learning actually not to do that. It is learning about coexistence. It's cultivating the conditions that quite naturally begin to turn down the volume of selfing and turn down the volume of othering. And there's an almost, I think, an eternal law that the more I and you, I and others is present, the less joy. The minimizing, the calming of those impulses, the greater the joy. Now, mudita, appreciative joy, is always relational and speaks very directly to one of the most deeply embedded views or habit patterns And in Pali, as I mentioned, the word is mana, the conceit of self. And if any of you are feeling discouraged, this is one of the last remaining obstacles before full awakening. There's a few to go through first. Before we actually discover the operation of this. Now, there's two ways, of course, in which selfing is manifested in consciousness. One way is sakkayaditti. Okay, this is personality view. Okay, now this is a changing phenomena, isn't it? This is where we go through those changes in a day or in a lifetime of I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I'm fearful, I'm successful, I'm a failure. This is sakkayaditti. This is personality view. And personality view is formed and shaped by whatever event is identified with in the moment. So if there's identification with sadness, I become sad. If there's identification with jealousy, I'm a jealous person. If there's identification with an aversive thought, oh, I'm such an angry type. So sakkayaditti is something that is changing through a day and through a life. I'm sure you've seen this. Look back through a family photo album. Huh? Remember when, you know, you see the picture of you in the 60s, you know, the thriving hippie. I'm always going to be a hippie, you know, the Boy Scout, the this, you know. So some of the sakkayaditti is very momentary. And, of course, some of it has been repeated quite often in our lives, or even it's a story that's been told to us by others. You know, a child who's consistently told they are a failure or inadequate will actually be very likely to form a personality view out of that. So some of it is momentary, some of it is historical. Now, mana is something far more elusive. The conceit of self is something far more elusive, but extremely powerful. It governs how we relate, how we place ourselves in relationship to the world, how we place ourselves in relationship to others. It governs how we speak or when we're silent. It might govern whether you sit at the front of the hall or seek always to sit in the back. It governs what you aspire to or what you feel is impossible for you. It governs your sense of expectation inwardly, aspiration, or whether all of that is dampened. So mana is a thread, this conceit of self, that has these kind of tendrils, these sort of sneaky tendrils that spread out to affect and shape how we place ourselves in relationship to the world and in relationship to others. Three forms of mana. These are very distinct forms. I see myself as being better than others, superior to others. Someone makes a noise in the hall, I would never do that. You know, someone asks a question, I would never ask something so stupid like that. You know. Or I've got, you know, the most brilliant, yeah, please don't stop asking questions. I see myself as being superior or better than you. I see myself as being less than you, inferior to you, not as good as you. Or I see myself as we're all the same. We're all the same. Now, in a way, this sounds rather innocuous, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like such a big deal, really. It's a really big deal. It's a really big deal. It might determine actually whether in this moment you listen to all of this and think absolutely this is impossible for me. Or whether you feel inspired and say this is really possible for me. It governs self, it governs Sakaya ditti, it governs personality view. Because if I see myself as being inferior to you, less good than you, less able than you, what am I going to seize on in the repertoire of my thoughts and emotions and appearance? I'm going to seize on everything that reaffirms that view. Oh, that shows, you know, I did this, you know, I made the noise. Of course I'm a failure, you know, I'm one of those people who's always doing something wrong, you know. Mana, the conceit of self, is always implicated in the shaping of personality view. If I have a deeply embedded view that I'm somehow less than you, that's going to be implicated in constantly forming this view, this momentary view, implicated in what is seized upon in the repertoire of my emotional, psychological life world. If I feel worse than you, I may engage in a lot of cynicism, envy, comparison. So it's going to suffocate joy. Mana is the greatest saboteur of the Brahma-viharas. Mana is the greatest saboteur of the Brahma-viharas. If I feel better than you, you know, I'm not going to have a lot of room, actually, for metta or compassion. I'm going to think it's your fault. You know, you should have made better choices. You know? If I'm going to feel myself to be inferior to you, there's not a lot of room there for appreciative joy, is there? You know, of celebrating the well-being and the happiness of others. And if I feel that we're all the same, there's actually not much room for any of the Brahma-viharas. If I feel myself to be worse than you, I may also be prone to be very, very judgmental. Not only of myself, but I actually want to see what's wrong with you. You know, I actually want to hide, you know, want to pick apart, you know, your imperfections and your flaws. I want you to bring you to my level of inferiority so I can relate to you. So I don't feel lessened. So it's very hard, actually, to have an honest kind of appreciation of anybody else. This is a huge... Mana is an eye maker. It's a self maker. It creates the self of the moment. If I feel myself, you know, somehow superior, I'm going to need to strive endlessly to keep hold of that position, you know, so that actually I'm always above you in some way. I may become very fearful of loss and cling to all I have. I may be a hoarder of praise and afraid of blame. And one of the most difficult aspects of mana is actually the sameness conceit. You know, we're all the same. Leads to a lot of cynicism. It makes us very difficult to actually celebrate the good fortune. Swimming in the sea of mediocrity. You know, no one can be enlightened. It's all just a story. You know, we're all deluded. We're all angry. What's going on behind those statements? They're very easy to fall into. And I'm pretty sure I won't even try, you know. I'll sit in a cushion and feel that it's really a lucky accident if I run into a breath every now and then, you know. It's a kind of disabler of skillful effort, isn't it? You know, because nothing's possible. We're all just the same. Now, mana is usually operating on quite a subconscious level, I think, and yet it really closes the door to mudita, to joy in every aspect. And this is where the cultivation of mudita is so important, where we actually really consciously learn to celebrate the happiness, the good fortune, the wellness, what can be appreciated. Because this is beginning to tone down the comparing, the evaluating mind. Now, in practice of mudita, in the actual form, and it is a formal practice. All of the Brahma Viharas are quite formal pathways of cultivation. We actually learn to get comfortable in these kind of intentions. How wonderful you are in your being. We pass somebody on the street. We don't know them. How wonderful you are in your being. I'm delighted that you're here. We don't need to know a story. We don't need to have a narrative to actually incline the mind towards appreciation. We don't need to have proof. And again, we learn to drop those phrases in, whether they're directed outwardly or whether they're turned inwardly, and not again repeat them like mantras, to make a lot of pauses in between and to listen inwardly. To listen inwardly and to listen to whatever responses arises. And we begin to tune in to this capacity for this inwardly generated happiness. And it's a spectrum, It doesn't mean, huge delight. It doesn't mean huge, big events. The cultivation of this inner sense of gladness and contentment and appreciation, learning to make room for joy, requires mindfulness, requires us to be able to pause, to stop, to see wholeheartedly, to listen wholeheartedly. We can use the phrases in formal practice, moving again, even as we do in metta and compassion, through different domains of human experience. But we can also use this with nature, with all the moments that we're in, learning to incline the mind. And I think it's really important to see the fluidity of the Brahma Viharas as we've talked about them so far. Although they can be developed and cultivated quite individually, sometimes we may be cultivating compassion and feel the heart begin to get a bit raw. We actually move to mudita, We may feel that mudita is becoming a little bit sort of spacey. We move back to metta, and we really ground that befriending, that approaching. So it's almost learning to have that fluidity through these qualities, learning their cultivation, learning that they're part of a whole, part of the landscape, actually, of a liberated mind, I would say. And learning how we can move between these as if we were playing a scale on a musical instrument. Knowing simply that what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind and the shape of our life, and that what we feed will grow. What we feed will grow. And, and enjoying and drawing upon the freedom that sati brings, that mindfulness brings, to be able to choose where we make our home and what we dwell upon. Okay, so are there any... yes, please.
I couldn't help notice when you talked about the term loving kindness, one of your troubles with that phrase was there's implicit emotion associated with feeling that you may not feel. And it kind of sounds the same when you hear appreciative joy, that if you don't actually feel the joy, is there a danger as well? Could you talk about
it? Well, there's always a danger of trying to... Well, the question is, yesterday I spoke about you don't have to feel friendly in order to act with metta. And that the reason I don't use the phrase, the terminology, loving kindness anymore, because it seems to imply that you are feeling something first. It's a twofold, there's a subtlety in this, because it's not about pretending, and we don't fool ourselves. I mean, part of meditative development, I think, it's a path of learning to be increasingly honest with ourselves. But I think from the perspective, so it's very important that we're not imagining a kind of feeling, but we're cultivating the conditions that allow certain qualities of mind to come into being. Now, appreciative joy does have an emotional nuance. It does. You know, it's like every mental event will have an emotional nuance. We're not striving to get that emotional nuance, but we're making room for what is wholesome and skillful to arise. Not what I like, not what I crave for, but actually what is wholesome and skillful to arise. And joy, appreciative joy, certainly falls within the spectrum of that which is wholesome, liberating, skillful. So there is a cultivation, and not to imagine it doesn't have an emotional nuance. I mean, aversion has an emotional nuance, you know, but not to feel that that has to come first, not to feel that it's a forerunner, you know, that actually we're making room for joy. And that's a little bit a question of opening our eyes and opening our hearts. And for me, it's always interesting in the Buddha's teaching. And teaching from the Tibetan tradition, it says that when we look at the great Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the yogis of the past and all of the trials that they went through in the journey of becoming a Buddha and a Bodhisattva, we imagine that this is not possible for us. And it is possible for us. It is simply by acting like a Buddha that they became so. You know, and it's so interesting for me in the Buddhist teaching, you know, the stress upon, for example, ethical behavior, you know, the stress upon committing to a behavioral way of being in the world, not only behavioral physically, but behavioral in the mind. You know, the stress of a behavioral way of being in the world, of experience with others, with ourselves, that actually the skillful qualities are going to catch up with that behavioral way of being. Just like the unskillful catches up with the behavioral way of being. And so that emphasis in the Buddhist tradition, it shouldn't be a surprise to us, should it? I mean, there's a closed feedback loop, isn't there, between somatic expression and mental state. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise to us, you know. If my mind is dull and my body sinks, my body is sending a message back to my mind saying, why not get more dull? You know, if my mind is very agitated and I'm all busy and agitated, you know, it's sending a message back to my mind saying, why not become more frenzied, you know? So it shouldn't be a surprise to us either from the perspective of the historical teachings or even from contemporary psychological teaching, you know. So the emphasis upon the interface between behavior and mental state. So, you know, sometimes we imagine we have to have the right mental state before we act in a certain way. And actually what the Buddha is suggesting is we act in a certain way and we commit to that. We don't pretend, but we have a commitment to it. And actually the mind is going to respond to that. It's very, I think this is really such an important area of exploration because it means everything matters, you know, both how we use our body and how we use our mind, you know. And if I give you like a simple example of this, you know, a few months ago I was teaching in a nearby city and I had to take the train every day. And the first day I showed up on the platform and I saw someone I hadn't seen in quite a few years who'd actually done some quite harmful things. And I saw them, and I saw my first response was, oh, there's that person who's done these harmful things. And I kind of, you know, kept on my end of the platform, you know. Second day, showed up, there he was again. Ah, yes, there's the person who's done those harmful things. I'll stay on my side of the platform. It went on for 4 days, and I finally got tired of it. And I thought, this is absurd. You know, I am seeing this person through this eyes, and I am acting in a certain way because of that. I am acting in a certain way because of that. So on that day, I went up to him. How are you doing? You know, how are you? The mind changed immediately. You know, and this is part of course, both how mindfulness is cooperating with the Brahma-viharas, because it's being aware of that choice, being aware of views that are being held, being aware of how views are keeping us locked into a certain way of acting and behaving and shutting out the Brahma-viharas and actually having that commitment actually to change the view behaviorally It doesn't. I didn't have to feel like it. Amen. It's that kind of willingness to cross, sometimes behaviorally. And, you know, this is true, isn't it, of so many dimensions of our life, whether it's addictions or, you know, compulsions, that we make a commitment to a behavioral change and the mind catches up with it. So I think this is such a significant piece of this teaching, is that we don't have to feel kind in order to be kind. If we want to know what generosity feels like, be generous. You know? If we want to know what appreciation feels like, be appreciative. You know, if we want to know what metta feels like, act in a way of metta. You know, so it's almost I think of it as a kind of courage. I think of it as a kind of, it's a commitment of the heart to the wholesome and the liberating and the skillful, rather than the more unconscious but powerful commitment of the heart to the familiar and the known and the unhelpful. I mean, I don't know if that answers your question, but it was a long. But it's such a, for me, it's such a fascinating piece. I mean, and you think about how that pans out in our life. You know, you think about being on a retreat. Imagine if we said to people, oh, only come and sit if you really, really feel like it. You know, and if you don't feel like it, don't bother coming, you know, go have a nap or something, you know, or, you know, if we only go and walk if you really, really feel like, otherwise don't bother. You know, think of a parent, you know, a baby wakes in the middle of the night. Do I really, really feel like getting up? No. I do it anyway. Why? Because I'm actually drawing, you know, the awareness is allowing us to draw on some deeper aspiration than the mind state or the feeling of the moment. So I don't think this is unfamiliar territory for any of us, and it almost feels kind of counterintuitive, and yet it's also intuitive at the same time. It's counterintuitive in that it's swimming against the tide of the predominant emotion or mind state, but it's also intuitive in that it's drawing upon what we most deeply know to be of the greatest value and most liberating. So it's that paradoxical combination, I think. Yes,
please. I got lost a little bit with that seeing ourselves as all the same, because I immediately go to what I thought we want to all recognize that we have, that we all want to be happy, and you know,
that's not the kind of sameness.
Yeah, so,
okay.
So this one is about the saying we're all lost causes, or?
So the question is, the mana, which is about equality conceit, it's actually referred to often as equality or sameness conceit. It is a statement of impossibility. It's very, very different than recognizing our shared humanity, in which there's all kinds of fluidity and possibility and appreciation. Mana is fixing a shared humanity into an imprisoned view of impossibility.
Could you repeat that Sri Lanka thing?
Yes. Thing?
Statement, affirmation.
It's not an affirmation. It's an articulation of intention.
It's very helpful.
Yeah. Thing. How wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I take joy in your good fortune. May your happiness continue.
It doesn't put you in the emotion, but it sort of gets you on.
It's an intention. It's inclining the mind,
yeah.
Inclining the heart in a particular way.
Is there more to that?
So the question is about how, talking about mana and how the cultivation of the Brahma-Viharas starts to actually untangle those knots of mana, because, you know, mana is the saboteur of the Brahma-Viharas. The Brahma-Viharas reveals mana. You know, we see that in all of the Brahma-Viharas, you know, because mana takes us into the near enemies of the Brahma-Viharas, is what mana does, okay? So, you know, it takes us into the near enemies of pity, of sentimentality, of resentment. So mana is always taking us into the near enemies of the Brahma-Viharas.
It's the word mana.
mana, M-A-N-A.
Victory.
Yeah. So mana is always taking us into the near enemies of the Brahma Viharas, okay? Which is why there are mana is a saboteur of the Brahma Viharas, because we start to mistake, because the near enemies of the Brahma Viharas, pity, sentimentality, envy, blame, you know, they keep reinforcing mana, don't they? I'm better than you, I'm worse than you, I'm the same as you. So mana is triggering those near enemies that we often mistake for being the Brahma Viharas, but actually they're actually reinforcing mana.
And through those views?
Well, we start, I think, through the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas clearly as insight practices, you know, not as concentration practices. They're very designated to actually look at almost the symptoms of mana. They start to reveal the symptoms of mana because they start to reveal the places where the Brahma Viharas feel inaccessible and closed because of the presence of aversion or craving or envy or jealousy or anxiety. The Brahma Viharas start to reveal that emotional world that actually closes the doors to the Brahma Viharas. I mean, it's a very experiential unfoldment. But, you know, it is why I would stress that the Brahma Viharas are so important as being cultivated as insight practices rather than as, because none of that's going to happen as a concentration practice. Yeah? None of that's going to happen as a concentration practice. Yes. So the question is that three dimensions of mana seem to correspond to those three kind of toxic elements of greed, hatred, and delusion. They have certainly that it's supported obviously by those three trends. However, I wouldn't say that one dimension of mana has domain over just one of those threads. They're actually all run through. Yeah. Yes, please. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, the question is about the story I told about the meeting the person on the train platform, you know, my initial avoidance mechanisms turning into a willingness to meet mechanism. And, you know, we sort of have a very strange belief that avoidance protects us and protects some a quality of vulnerability. Yes, you know, even if I use that example, I had no idea in making that shift and going to say hello and, you know, generate some befriending, whether that was going to result in, you know, some terrible feedback or you know, even more of the same, even though the original harm wasn't directed towards me. I had no idea whether that was going to change. But that is actually the kind of leap that we make, I think, with the Brahma Viharas. You know, we don't kind of sidle our way up to befriending. Or sometimes we do, but we're also aware that aversion doesn't actually protect us. Avoidance doesn't protect us. It makes us more fearful. It reifies the capacity of something to harm us, rather than actually trusting in our own capacity to meet the difficult. You know, so avoidance doesn't, even though it has an appearance of protecting, guarding vulnerability, it actually makes us more vulnerable. And I think that's, you know, and then it feels like it is a leap, actually, that it's a kind of leap of courage. It's almost a leap of confidence to change that or to step outside of the boundaries of that behavioral pattern. And sometimes it might result in getting, you know, exposing ourselves to the difficult or the painful. But there's also a statement of inner confidence in making that leap, you know, and inner confidence in our capacity to not personalize the mind state of another. You know, it's not saying something about us. It is saying something about their mind state. So there's a whole kind of untangling that is going on in there around you know, around non-identification and around equanimity, which we will get into this afternoon. But sometimes it is a leap of confidence. It's a kind of a commitment. And, you know, that feels risky at times, and it does feel risky at times, and maybe it is risky at times, but we also need to determine for ourselves, do I hang my hat on that voice of doubt that says I'm unable to embrace the difficult, or do I hang my hat? And, you know, it's not always wise to do what I say by that example, by the way, you know. But sometimes we need to see where avoidance has actually got nothing to do with, you know, genuine harm or risk, and when it's just a pattern. So, again, thank you for your attention. And I think if we take just a few minutes to sit, and then we'll break for lunch.